Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Really pleased to welcome back to the microphones Dean Bacopoulos. He is now a professor in the MFA program in creative writing and environment at Iowa State University. His first novel, he was visited with us when that came out, and that novel is titled Please Don't Come Back from the Moon. I love that book. It was set in his hometown of Detroit. His second novel, which is out this month, is titled My American Unhappiness. And it is set in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Dean, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be back.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment, are you happy, or would you answer Zeke, the lead character in this book? How would you answer his survey question of why are you so unhappy with a long, detailed response? Would you do that? What are the currents you see just below the surface in Midwest life that may not that you may not see or that others may not see? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can reach us via email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question there. And Dean, it is great to have you back.
Thanks. It's so great to come back to Wisconsin. We've been doing it every summer, coming back to Mineral Point, Wisconsin. And, oh, man, it's a hard place to leave. So it's great to be here.
Well, you know, and you lived in Madison for
8 years, 8 or 9 years, and then another 3.5, 4 years in Mineral Point. So in southern Wisconsin for over a decade.
Yeah, and it's your first book. You lived in Detroit. Your first book was set there.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in Madison. This book set there. Is that why you move around? So
I think my wife's beginning to wonder that. If we need to move every time I start a novel. No, the third book's set in Wisconsin. So I think I found what Faulkner referred to as your personal postage stamp that you're going to write about in Wisconsin. I think the next few books I have in mind are Wisconsin books. So it's interesting. I live in Iowa now during the school year, and I think that there's an Iowa novel sometime down the line, but I haven't got enough of a feel on Iowa yet.
Different from Wisconsin.
Well, yeah, people from the coast feel like it's all the same out here, and they're like, what's the difference? And I said, it's like it's moving to a different country. It's a little different culture, a little different community, and so I'm still feel like very much a foreigner there. And when I get back to Wisconsin, as soon as we come over the Mississippi River past Dubuque, we all kind of exhale and feel like we're back home.
Well, you know, the title, My American Unhappiness, is really not an, most ways, it's not an unhappy book. It's kind of a funny, although you might sometimes say, call it dark humor, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a darkly comic novel about a guy, Zeke Pappas, who's facing a crack-up. And in terms of both everything he thought he believed in is sort of falling apart underneath him, and then his own personal life is becoming clear to him as sort of a mess. And that word "my" in the title, My American Unhappiness, I thought was sort of a bit of a wink to how personal our unhappiness feels, even when really, from the outsider's perspective, we're pretty lucky, so many of us. But when we start to look at what makes me unhappy, it becomes a very sort of focused and sometimes absurd, sometimes credible unhappiness that's taken over our lives, even though we really are lucky on so many levels.
Yeah, we definitely are lucky on many, many levels. And I detected some things in Zeke that are you have some things that are in common with you, certainly some things that are definitely not in common.
Right. Yeah. You know, Zeke works for something called the Great Midwestern Humanities Initiative, and I think it's well known to people who've read my first book that I was director of the Wisconsin Humanities Council here in Madison. That's sort of where the similarities end in terms of work life. You know, I think when I managed an actual nonprofit, we worked very, very hard, and we spent a lot of hours being very cautious of how we spent both private and public money. Zeke is a little more arrogant, and he just decides, he picks a project. He convinces himself sometimes with sort of absurd rhetoric that the project is well worth funding, and he just goes off without really paying attention to the forms he fills out. And I guess in navigating the bureaucracy of something like the world of nonprofits, and especially as affiliated with universities and the federal government, there were days where I just wanted to just ignore the regulations and just do something. And so some of that definitely came out of the frustration of having to be beholden to an institution. But I think ultimately they were good institutions, but there were days where
you wanted to, but you didn't.
I didn't. No, no. We passed our audits with flying colors when I was in charge. So
that was the thing that drove me crazy about Zeke in the book, because he would. I don't know if it's this Midwest ideal or whatever. You would not ignore some of the things that he ignores.
Yeah, I think he starts to feel that institutions are what makes a lot of Americans unhappy. We become very dependent to big institutions. So he becomes a sort of Don Quixote, deciding like he's going to be the guy to free us from the chains, to sort of accomplish what Emerson wanted to accomplish with self-reliance. And he goes off on a little zany quest at work, which is less zany than his attempt to find a wife, which becomes sort of the real thing that he's trying to do in the book.
And he's doing this survey. Mm-hmm. Asking people why they are so unhappy.
Yeah, he has his pet project, which has really taken up all the funding at his nonprofit and caused most of the staff to resign, is something called the Inventory of American Unhappiness. And it's, in terms of scholarship, it's pretty bad scholarship.
It sure is.
I think like some of the oral historians I worked with in Wisconsin would,
cringe.
Yeah, they would definitely cringe at Zeke's methodology. But he just goes up to people at random and says, "Why are you so unhappy?" And he's amazed that so many of them, with that question thrown at them unexpectedly, have an answer that is fairly in-depth and involved. And so Zeke's thesis is that Americans are walking around with something that is burdening them on almost any given day.
Yeah. Barbara in Oconomowoc with us. Barb, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. I'm 62. I'm going to be 63 in a few days, and that upsets me. And the fact that summer solstice is happening and the days are going to get shorter, and it's always at this time of year, I just get very depressed and unhappy, and just question my being.
I think that in this book, there's a lot of people that Zeke interviews, who really have this sensitivity to their environment and to this passing of time. I think the artistic personality is always aware that the days are going, and that alone can be sort of paralyzing. And I think, a lot of the complaints Zeke hears are pretty absurd, but every so often there's something like that is so true of the human condition. No matter how good things are going with us on a logistical level, there's sometimes this sort of philosophical core that nags at us and makes us feel like it's going too fast and there's nothing I can do to stop it. And helplessness is often the root of unhappiness, feeling you're powerless to change it. And certainly, I'm not sure anybody can solve that problem and make the days last longer and make time go slower. So that's the thing that I think causes a lot of folks to feel that way.
Did you, in your, and thank you, Barbara, for calling, did you in your writing, or when you were putting this book together, did you do any surveys a la Zeke surveys?
I did. I had some early emails from people. I posted on Facebook when I was just on Facebook. I posted this question, and I warned people that I might use a few of their answers. And I actually did use a few of the answers in the book that people sent to me via Facebook, to kind of get a read on how people I know in my generation might they respond to it, to know if I was being totally off base or if I was onto something. And I quickly saw that the fictional responses were not much different than the true responses that came in. I think that was one of those encouraging moments in writing the book, that maybe Zeke's story was tapping into the zeitgeist somehow.
Yeah. And Barbara, I mean, her comments related to her sadness revolves around milestones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I tend to share that as a father of two little kids, a 6-year-old and 3-year-old. Hi, everybody. They're probably listening. This is the first time Daddy's been on the radio that they've listened to it. But anyhow, I get, you know, I sometimes feel quite sad that I miss things when I'm traveling on the road, and you come home and you've missed somebody learning a new song or somebody, you know, playing a game for the first time, and you just think, why? Why did I miss that? And it becomes sort of obsessive. So the fact that, you know, you're missing things is a tough thing to deal with.
We have Chet in Spring Hill, Florida with us next. Chet, hi.
Hi. My question for Professor Bacopoulos is about Zeke Pappas, because I've read it, and I don't want to give anything away, but it seems to me that Zeke is like an everyman for... I'm 61. I look around at so many of the younger people who would like to have a lasting relationship, a marriage, a family, and they're really emotionally incapable of it, and I don't know why. Sometimes I think it's commitment or the ability to stay with something, and Zeke is wandering around trying to find that relationship, but can't. So I wondered if Professor Bacopoulos would like to comment on Zeke's inability to connect.
Hmm. Sure. Well, I think Zeke has a lot of issues about commitment, but I think on a larger level, Zeke represents a significant portion of my generation who is having trouble figuring out their niche. And I think the economic uncertainty we're dealing with in this country right now makes it very difficult to see yourself as being part of some sort of calling, as being part of something that is meant for you to do, and that includes relationships. I think this fragmented feeling that at some moment you're going to lose your job or your health insurance or have to move for another job seeps into our psyche, and I think there's a lot of people, if they don't find that special person to spend their life with, it becomes more and more difficult. And I think they just feel that tension in the air in this country right now, that nothing is permanent. And there's economic and environmental conditions, I think, that exacerbate that for my generation. So.
Yeah, yeah.
I should say I've been married for 14 years. I got married at 21. So I'm
And let's see, I've got my 15th wedding anniversary coming up in October. So yeah. You and I are in about the same plane there.
That's right.
Thanks, Chet, for calling. Appreciate it. Lloyd in Appleton, on to you. Hi, Lloyd.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to comment that the direct negative impact of this economy on individuals, I think, has everything to do with the unhappiness of many, many people that I know. People in their 50s and 60s who have worked very hard, you know, to accumulate some security, have seen most of that evaporate over the last 5 years. If you own real estate or mutual funds or pensions, you know, not only has the value, if you wanted to sell it, gone down by 30% or more, but if you want to spend what little money you do have in other economies, for example, in Europe or Canada, the dollar won't buy anything close to what it used to, and that is pretty depressing. You know, the lifestyle that most of us planned on just isn't available.
And that's kind of what you're writing about, isn't it, in some ways?
Yeah, I think, Lloyd, thanks for the call. I think you hit it head on. I think that there's just this change in the way we perceive security, I mean, economic security, domestic security as Americans, that shifted in the last few years. When I was writing the book, I was working on it around 2007, but it was really 2008 where the book took off, and it really changed with the collapse of the stock market in September 2008, partly because I was very personally affected by that. I had left my job at the Humanities Council to sort of go out a little bit more on my own, and it was a very tough time economically. Magazines I were writing for were closing up. My publisher was having some pretty serious economic woes, and my editor ended up leaving the publishing company. And we were out of money. There I am with two little kids, a fairly successful writing career and a decent resume, and having no idea how I was going to pay the bills, and paying $1,300 a month for health insurance. And after about 2 months of paralysis, I realized this is what Zeke needs to symbolize. Zeke has to symbolize the feeling of complete driftlessness, driftingness, another way, that is sort of taking over, the feeling that no matter what you did, you have to sort of change up your expectations. And that's really unsettling. And we're kind of in a transition, kind of living with consequences of an unsustainable sort of trajectory in this country. And now we're in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that many people I know, on one level, are very appreciative that we have so much more than folks in other cultures. But at the same time, like I said, you've seen expectations really evaporate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's to some extent that you it's not a blueprint for dealing with it, but it's like I think it's an idea of how people are dealing with it that you raise it, that you write about in your book.
Yeah, I think that you have to kind of allow a little bit of time for the dust to settle. And I think we're very much in a position in this country right now where we're trying to figure out what the next move is. Is there a next move, or is there a golden age that has ended? Sometimes I wake up feeling like the latter is true, and sometimes I have more optimism for putting us back on some sort of path to prosperity. But when you look at the political fighting in this country, it feels very much like it's a marriage that has fallen on hard times because of too much debt. I mean, debt is so stressful on a marriage, and this lack of resources is really contributing to some amazing rancor in politics too. It's a similar dynamic. People are unhappy. They can't get along. They're scared because they don't have what they need, and that goes all the way up to Washington and the state capitol as well.
Thanks, Lloyd. Dean Bacopoulos, our guest today. His latest book, just out, is titled My American Unhappiness. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. Are you happy? I'll tell you what, we'd love to hear from you, or maybe you're not happy. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you have a question about the book itself or about Dean's writing and how he goes about his business. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Steers-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And this unhappiness project, how did you come up with that idea for the unhappiness project?
Well, I think it's just a matter of I'm a great eavesdropper, so I'm always sort of listening into other people's conversations. And when I lived in Madison, I was amazed at sort of patterns I was hearing in people when they were in these earnest discussions in coffee shops or bars, and they were talking about their current woes and what was making them unhappy. There were just some motifs that kept popping up, and one of them was work. One of them was the idea that their job was underfunded. They were trying to find resources to keep their job afloat. They were working 60 hours where they used to work 40. And so I heard this sort of lament over and over from very talented, bright people. And then I heard sort of absurd comments, too, about the things that people got really angry about, the parking lot at Whole Foods or something like that, these things that really aren't huge problems. But on a daily basis, they do change your attitude towards the world. And so that really gave me the idea of the book, and I was trying to think, you know, who's the man, who's the character I can come up with to listen? And it had to be somebody who was a little obsessive and a little delusional and a little bit broken himself. And so he was going to put his own unhappiness on a back burner and really focus on the unhappiness of strangers.
And there are, he is a quirky guy. I think the stronger characters in terms of, not physical strength, but I mean, the women in the book are very strong. You have some pretty strong characters there.
Yeah, thank you. I was really trying to create people who Zeke might have pitied, who actually had things much more together. So he lives with his mother, and they raised these two twin nieces who were orphaned when Zeke's brother was killed in Iraq, and then his sister-in-law was killed in a car wreck shortly thereafter. So Zeke is raising 2 7-year-old twins with his mother. He and his mother don't see eye to eye on a lot of philosophical and political issues, and she works incredibly hard at a job that Zeke thinks is too menial, too difficult for somebody of her age. And he begins to pity her, though as it progresses, she's much more accepting of reality and accepting of the hardness of life, and he sees her as sort of naive, but she's definitely a foil to him. That he pities her throughout the book, but at the end of the book, she's the one who's much more grounded than he is.
Absolutely, and I think the love interests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Zeke believes he's in love with a lot of women who are nice to him because they have to be nice to him. So there's the woman at Starbucks who does sort of fall for him based on his quirk, though he kind of gets distant from him as she learns more about him. So he falls in love with the coffee shop worker. He falls in love with his administrative assistant because she has to be nice to him. He falls in love with the neighbor because he sees her every day. His relationships are all based on this social proximity. And because he hasn't had a real relationship in so long, he feels that these are meaningful, and he goes after them entirely too fast. And though I said a lot of this book isn't autobiographical, when I was, you know, a young man, a teenager, and then the first few years of college dating, I always fell in love way too quickly and sort of scared people away. Though eventually, when I was in England the summer I turned 20, I fell completely in love with somebody and told her that within the first few days, and we got married. So
it worked that
eventually
time.
Eventually it worked, yeah. Zeke's not so lucky.
Oh, man. Angela in La Crosse, we go to you now. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. Thank What's you. On your mind?
Well, I'm sitting here listening to this, and I am very fortunate, and I'm in a place in life, despite the economy, where things are going well, marriage, economically, and I almost feel bad about the fact that I'm happy. not not many people are, and I completely understand it. It's justifiable, but how do happy people assimilate with the unhappy people without making them feel bad?
Boy, that's a Midwest thought, isn't it? I tell you what, for a Midwesterner.
Wisconsin is, you know, the friendliest state, and that's such a Wisconsin question. Is like, you know, things are going so well, I don't want to make the unhappy people know about it. There's a modesty in the Midwest, and I think it's a healthy one, that you don't want to brag about things that are going really well. At the same time, you know, sometimes that can be an example for people. It can be sort of inspiring that somebody feels happy, because I think no one's life is perfect, and I think so much of it is a matter of perception as to what you really need. We are very much an if-only culture, and so a lot of the unhappiness we see is, if only I had a better coffee maker, if only there was a skylight in my bathroom, and it goes up and up from there. But I think happy people don't think if only. They think, right, this is really, really good. And they don't go into that next sentence, that if only. And that's something I've just learned to do in my own life, is to realize how good things have gone for me. And there are things that maybe, if only I had a better car, if only I had, you know, more free time. But at the same time, that's the way to madness. And I think, you know, happy friends can help their unhappy friends realize that things are pretty good, and drop that if only kind of thinking can really help.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Thanks, Angela.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. We have John in Janesville up next. Hi, John.
Yes, Larry and guest. The whole system is systematically and fundamentally flawed. And unless we start getting honest in this country, which we're never going to do because of our nature, we're full of hubris and vainglorious attitudes of all kinds. The population, for instance, has just simply outstripped the job market, and there's never really going to be any recovery whatsoever.
Whoa, that's negative.
Yeah, it's negative, but I do think that he's pointing to something a lot of people feel. The systems we believed in, the institutions that were supposed to take care of us, whether they were big corporations that employed us, or the federal government, or smaller institutions, the banks, things like this, have failed us to some extent. And they do breed this mistrust and this feeling that all is lost. There's nothing we can do to survive because they've taken too much from us. And that's the feeling of unhappiness, I think, is at the core for a lot of people, is the institutions that we helped build with our resources, with our energy, with our trust, have turned on us. And I think that your last caller just articulates that a bit.
Yeah. Lynn, and thanks for calling, John. Lynn and Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Larry and Professor Bacopoulos. I'm not unhappy, but I feel that folks of my generation, baby boomers, and their parents suffered from an illusion of prosperity after the war. And we had all the can-do and credit that we misused. And then we raised a generation of children who we told could do anything they wanted to, and they couldn't. But now is the time to fall back on the institution that generally doesn't fail, and that's our family. It's time to to pull up your boots and be family again. So I'm really happy with that. I'm thrilled.
Yeah, I think family is the thing that you can count on and you can have some control over in terms of not screwing it up and trying to run it with love and fairness and justice in a way that other institutions might not run that way. I think, the baby boom question is interesting because baby boomers, I think, did a lot of great things, and they used a lot of resources, and they're going to continue to use a lot of resources as they get older. And the misstep has been not really thinking about when is the party going to be over. And I feel my generation, I turn 36 in a few weeks here. My generation is feeling very much as if we're living in what my friend Kurt Miney over in Sauk City talks about as being the age of consequences. Mm-hmm. That we are living with a lot of unsustainable thinking, and it's sort of a taxing thing to carry around. But you don't think about that when you're playing with your kids or you're seeing your parents. I mean, hopefully you can relax a bit.
Thanks for calling, Lynn. Appreciate it. Patty in Eau Claire, we're giving you a chance now. Hi, Patty.
Yes, good morning. It's incredible that you're having this on. I've been struggling with this on a very deep level. Part of me is angry at the news and the leaders because they keep talking about the slow recovery. And I'm absolutely convinced that there is not going to be a recovery. We are not going back to the golden age. It's all different. But then that's countered with, okay, so what do I want to do with my life now? I'm 55, and I'm fantasizing all kinds of things. I might sell my house, get an RV, and just travel. I'm taking cues from my 25-year-old and her young friends. They're running around the world working on organic farms. My 25-year-old daughter, who graduated at the top of her class from college, but can't find a job. Now, she's in fine arts, so there is that. But she's been traveling around the world living off of $7,000 for 2 years, woofing, which is working organic farms, making connections with people from all around the world, doing internships. It's just time. It's a chance for us to get out of the box. Don't wait for the leaders because they're way behind. Get out of the box, be creative, and do what we want.
Yeah.
I think one of the freeing things about the situation we're in is, like, there's no right way to go. There used to be maybe some careers you would try to steer your children to because they were quote-unquote secure careers, right? Engineering or teachers. But those are the people who are being laid off, too. And those are people who are struggling to make ends meet. Their pay is going down. So there isn't any secure profession, and I think that does bring a bit of exuberant freedom to the next generation, especially when you are sort of have no dependents and can run around and do those sorts of things, which I think are the way to go, to find your calling, to find out the thing that's going to make you happy and not worry about tying yourself to a large institution. The tricky thing is, because I went up the lone wolf road as a novelist when I quit the Humanities Council, is there are some real concerns, like unaffordable cost of health insurance and the difficulty of finding shelter when you're doing these things when you got a family. So I think that there is a real flip side to that. But those who are just coming out of school and those who are in sort of empty nest retirement, I think there is some really thrilling exuberance that this sort of unsteady economy can bring.
Yeah. You have a subplot. Before we go back, thank you again for calling. There's a subplot many subplots to your book. You've got federal agents, Homeland Security, politicians get caught with their pants down.
Where do I come up with this stuff?
Yeah, how could you ever conceive of these things?
Yeah, there are definitely the book started as almost a political allegory. It became something much more personal and I think broadly comic. But there are these sinister federal agents from the Department of Departmental Compliance who are part of a secret Homeland Security force called the Cynic Cessation Project, and they are going after Zeke because he's too cynical. Well, it turns out he also has misappropriated federal funds and is in quite a bit of trouble based on his own sort of delusions of grandeur. But there are a lot of subplots. I wanted the book to have this surreal feel. You know, Zeke can go into a Starbucks and guess any stranger's drink order by just looking at them, or can go through these sort of weird, almost Kafka-esque moments with federal agents. Because I do think we're living in a very surreal time, and there are experiences we have trying to navigate this time that I think feel increasingly surreal. And I think there's no coincidence that the most surreal, absurd literature came out of Eastern Europe and Latin America in times of intense dictatorship and uncertainty. And I think as American literature gets to deal, where novelists are dealing more and more with our political and economic uncertainty, you're going to see more surreal, more absurd literature coming from contemporary authors.
We had an email from Amanda in Mineral Point who read the book. Zeke Pappas feels constrained by the regulations of institutional bureaucracy, which you point to as a potential cause of unhappiness in our work with professional lives. But in real life, aren't those regulations meant to protect public funds and institutions from misuse in just the way Zeke eventually misuses those for kind of bogus scholarship, you might say, and personal pursuits?
I think so. I mean, I think the institutional regulations are there for a reason. I think there's some wonderful people who enforce those regulations. They're always, my feeling is they're always much more human than the federal agents in my book. But we've gone, I think, the opposite direction. We're so afraid of anything fraudulent or anything that's potentially seen as frivolous. We don't take a lot of risks in the kinds of things we invest in this country. And so while I think the oversight is really important, I think the paralysis of not spending anything that might be at all unpopular in terms of an investment that you think is good for the country, it's very strange. It's a very strange feeling that anything that's too remotely risky or too intellectually on the edge might be considered a threat to public safety. I think we have this maniac optimism in this country, and I think optimism is good, but maniacal optimism gets a little crazy, and that's sort of what Zeke is part of the problem. He's railing against this maniacal optimism that says you have to always be positive, but he becomes maniacally optimistic about his own personal situation too.
Yeah. Dave and Augusta, we turn to you next. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Oh, great topic. I really enjoyed the previous 45 minutes. At age 54, I have decided that by watching people around me lose money, invest money, complain about not having not enough money. The whole idea of being unhappy is not having enough money. Now, of course, there's other reasons too. You know, physical problems and things like that, family problems. But I think a lot of this is about money. Now, at my age of 54, I've got just enough money where I'm able to go out and get a gallon of milk and a six-pack of beer and afford a fishing license. To me, happiness is to go out and walk across the road and go trout fishing or go slip my boat into a nice musky lake in northern Wisconsin. Other people, the more they get, the more they want. And I think part of that unhappiness is their inability to keep up with the Joneses. Am I touching on something here?
Oh, yeah. I think you're very right about that, that money feels like the thing we can control. So when we're sorrowful, it's because of illness or some really horrific thing. That's sorrow. That's sadness. That's real emotion. Unhappiness is this feeling like we should be able to fix something. If only we did this, we'd have more. But it is true that people really are striving for things they don't need. And if you can find simple pleasures in life, you're going to be much happier in things that don't cost a whole lot of money. I mean, I think that there are people now increasingly who don't even have the pocket money for the fishing license and the six-pack, and I think that's where you can see the desperation set in. But I do think you have to set your priorities to be happy from simple experiences, and just like you're talking about, you'll be much, much more stable person if you don't try to keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Dave. Karen emailed to say amen to the get-out-of-the-box caller from earlier. I have many reasons to feel insecure and worried, and I do listen to the things will get better statements with healthy skepticism, but I also have loved ones and my own capabilities to be grateful for. I believe things will change and ways the public at large is reluctant to face. If we're alive and curious and open, we can do this.
Yeah, I think so. I think that in sort of admitting that you feel unhappy and then being able to shed that is, I think, a big part of the transition people will have on this topic. I think if you start to say, okay, I do feel unhappy, I do feel like I've been wronged by an institution or I didn't see this coming, you can let it go. I mean, I was pretty unhappy when I wrote this funny this funny novel called My American Unhappiness. I was unhappy. I would say I just got back from a 9-city book tour, and I felt as happy as I felt in a long time. I was tired, but I was very happy. So,
well, and it is a funny book. I mean, the title just does not go anywhere close to describing what you read and laugh about and chuckle about in the book. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, Zeke sort of gets in some very slapstick situations.
Oh, man.
People are pulling tasers on him, and he's getting caught with his pants down literally, and he's just all sorts of problems. And he always thinks he's just about ready to solve a problem. And, of course, hijinks ensue.
Hijinks ensue. But I will say that I don't want to give anything away, but he does find some peace and contentment in kind of an unexpected setting. And, you know, I really was glad you did. I was really happy for that.
Mm-hmm. I think, without giving away what happens at the end, he starts to understand what hope means and that it doesn't always have to lead to instant changes. And he also starts to live in the moment and realize there's parts of his personality and parts of this culture that he can't change. And I think in the final moments of the book, he starts to be happy, even though some readings might be different. I think he's fairly happy in the last few moments of the book.
I do too. And Dean, it's been a real pleasure to speak
Thank
with you.
You
today.
It was great fun. Thank you.
Dean Bacopoulos is the author of My American Unhappiness. You have a website, do you?
Yeah. It's my name, deanbacopoulos.com, which is DEANBAKOPOULOS. Or you can go to my fan page on Facebook, same thing, Dean Bacopoulos.
Thank you so much. And I really enjoyed the book, and I think you will too. And certainly all the callers who called today, I know they're going to enjoy the book, and I bet you will too. My American Unhappiness, and Dean's last name is spelled Bacopoulos. Dean Bacopoulos. Coming up, we're going to take a look at another book that relates to a totally different topic. We'll talk about gardening. The title of the book is Garden Rules, the Snappy Synopsis for the Modern Gardener. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The great lyric poet of Iran is Hafez, who lived in 14th century Shiraz. Like Dante, his inspiration was a woman, but he married and survived local politics, religious censure, and Tamerlane's invasion. I'm Jean Faraca. Join us for the poetry of Hafez today at 3 here on Earth.
Support for WPR comes from the Jewelers Workshop, 301 North Sherman Avenue, dedicated to repairing and fashioning locally crafted custom jewelry from recycled gold and gems, preserving family memories. Details at jewelersworkshop.com.
Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network. You know, gardening, it's a lot of fun, a lot of fun. Can be frustrating, too. And my guests today until 12:30 are the co-authors of a new book. It's called Garden Rules, The Snappy Synopsis for the Modern Gardeners. And their goal, I think, in this is to demystify gardening. And it's a really fun read, and I'm really glad to have the authors with me today by phone. Jamie Jenkins is the founder of AHA, Modern Living, and the host of the home and garden podcast Nest in Style. Billy Brownell is a longtime editor of Garden Books, and they are, if I can get them on here, I'll push the buttons, I'll get them on. There we go. They are the co-authors of the book, Garden Rules. And so we'll talk about gardening and garden rules with our guests. If you're a gardener, is a basic garden question you feel like everybody knows but you? Well, you could probably ask it. What are your garden? Do you have some garden rules of your own? My wife has some garden rules. It often involves me staying out of the garden while she's working in the garden. Because I tend to sometimes pull weeds that are not always weeds. Even though I had a lot of experience in gardening, that's kind of the way it works around our place. What about you? Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And go to our Facebook page, too. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a comment there. And Judith will, I'm sure, find it and send it on to me. And let's turn to Jamie Jenkins. Are you there?
I'm here, Larry. How are you? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Great. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Is Billy around as well?
I'm around. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for taking time to be with us today, and I'm loving your book here. What possessed you to put it together?
Well, I think I'm going to let Billy take this one. It's her baby, that's for sure.
All right, Billy.
Basically, you know, as a garden editor, I read a lot of garden material, and sometimes, you know, when I read the same description of deadheading, I can practically recite it in my sleep, you know, removing spent flowers. And I thought, you know, but if you don't know what a spent flower is, you may not know what to do. So I would challenge writers sometimes, you know, just a little brief description, explain what it is. And I thought that's what we really need, is something where people can remember things just by the titles, instead of reading a long explanation. There's so much to learn in gardening that there's room for all kinds of books of all kinds of lengths. But I know that I wanted the shortcut method. Personally.
Yeah.
I need the shortcut method.
And Jamie, I think the book does give gardeners some hope, those gardeners especially who might think that they're just not meant to be able to grow anything.
Well, yeah, there's plenty of them out there. I mean, having my own online store, I've talked to many people who don't think of themselves as gardeners or just feel too overwhelmed of all the things you have to learn to just grow a plant or to grow a tomato plant. And Billy's concept of taking garden rules, you know, so to speak, and taking them into bite-sized information so that you can, you know, over a day, learn what exactly you need to know just to get started. You know, it's just a jumping point to bigger and better things, you know, along down the future.
Well, I tell you, and I love your titles for each page or each little chapter here.
Good.
Test soil with your bare bottom. Plant murder is not a felony.
My favorite.
Why is plant for a murder not a felony?
Well, for one thing, they can't fight back while they're dead. They can when they're alive. If you've ever had a holly attack you, you know, that was a breakthrough moment for me as a homeowner and a gardener, was to realize that I was in control. I didn't have to bend myself around the will of the plant. It was there for me to enjoy, and if I didn't like it, then out it could go. And it actually was freeing from that moment on. If I didn't like something, I either moved it or got rid of it.
Yeah.
I think about that is, you know, people who think that kill plants, that they're not gardeners. Well, I'm sorry, every experienced gardener is going to kill something, whether they want to or not, you know. And so it's just a fact of gardening. It's the way of life in the garden. So, and it's okay. It's acceptable.
Yeah, I guess it is. Now, I'm going to ask you, I don't know if I should ask this or not, but have you ever sat in the soil with your bare bottom?
I've walked barefoot without football. If you can walk on the ground and it's not so chilly that you're uncomfortable, then you're pretty much okay.
Well, I had a friend, Mark Larson, who was a gardener. He's a professor out in California now, and he always bared his bottom and sat in the soil to test the soil for planting. He would actually do it.
I'm impressed.
When I was younger, that's for sure, but I can't say I do it now.
Well, I have never been there to actually see him do it, thankfully, but at least that's what he claimed. Billy, you talk a lot about watering. One of the tips is to water less often but longer, and talk a little bit about why that's better.
That's important because plant roots are pretty much like people in many respects. They do as much as they have to do to get by. And if you're watering frequently but shallowly, can I say that correctly?
Yeah.
What you do is you actually train the roots to be near the surface so that when there is a drought or if you're on vacation or if you miss some watering, the roots are more affected than if you had been watering deeply into the soil so that they're reaching down to reach the wet ground. You want plant roots to grow as deep as they can.
And kind of to go along with that, you also give some advice on when to get out the hose and when is it best.
Well, this is one of those things that I actually, you know, the conventional wisdom is water as the temperature is rising. But I found that I have more time at night. But if you're watering by hand with a watering can or the hose, I really recommend not so much doing the hose because people don't tend to water enough. But if you have container plants, you're watering at their base anyway. You're not getting the leaves wet. That's the rationale for not watering at night, is that your foliage becomes wet. As long as you're not dampening the foliage, you can pretty much water anytime you want.
Yeah. Well, Lorraine in Madison, I think, is seconding your earlier comments. She says, I think we all love and also hate experts like Martha Stewart, who make it look so easy and so impossible to live up to.
She has an immense staff. I know this because I know someone who visited her. And I'm like, oh, if we only all had staff.
That was one of my rules that Billy actually didn't think belonged in the book, was to hire a bunch of garden minions to make life easier in the garden. But, you know, that's just not practical for most of us.
But
oh,
man.
You can do it, you know, Jamie. More power to you.
Yeah.
Phil in Hebron, Illinois, up here. Phil, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, you guys. I wanted to give you a little quote from a professor I had when I was studying horticulture, who's kind of world renowned for his plant expertise, and he always said, I haven't even attempted to grow the plant if I haven't killed it at least two times.
There you go.
And that was Michael Durr, who's kind of well known.
Oh, he's got one of the books on gardening, yeah.
Well, that is so true. I mean, a lot of what you will learn in the garden is from your mistakes, and a lot of those mistakes come from killing plants. And so you learn what, you know, it's just as helpful as learning what doesn't work as knowing what does work. So
he was fond of saying is, you can read the book and it tells you all about the plant, but the problem is the plant never reads the book, Phil.
Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you so much, Phil, for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 with your question or with your comment. You're supposed to, Jamie, I want to go to you for a minute, because you're a proponent of edible plants in a lot more places than just the vegetable garden. What are some of your favorites?
Some of my favorite edible plants?
Yeah.
Things that are easier to grow and that I like to eat. So... one of the things, actually, I just discovered this year is that I will never grow radishes again. You know, they are easier to grow in so many different climates, and so I tend to recommend them for beginning gardeners. But I have just learned that I do not like to eat them. So I'm just not going to take up that valuable real estate in my backyard if I don't like to eat it. So out with the radishes. I'm growing to be a huge fan of arugula. I mean, a lot of these spicier lettuces. Lettuces are easy to grow. It's not one of the sexiest plants to grow, but there's so many different shapes and textures and colors that you can grow. And I love to put them in as like border plants, you know, as opposed to like putting annual flowers. I love to plant in my walkways lettuces and of all different sorts of colors and herbs and mix them, you know, with my annual flowers as well. Cucumbers and zucchinis, you know, they're so... You know, they are so, you can have an over an abundance of them.
Yeah, ubiquitous.
Good thing. Yeah, and it can be a bad thing. So, you know, if you're a family of two, you probably only need one or two zucchini plants. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be giving foot-long zucchinis away to your neighbors, and they don't necessarily like that.
I like that. Charlie in Fitchburg, on to you. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, I thought my short tip has worked pretty well. I take two 6-ounce yogurt cups, cut the bottom out of one of them, set it inside the second one, and then poke a small hole in the bottom, start the seeds in there like with tomatoes and things, and when they've grown a bit and the roots are well established, you just lift the inside cup out, take a bulb planter, make a hole in the ground, and drop it in. Very little shock, transplant shock, and also forces the roots to grow deep and provides a little bit of protection as well from grubs and other things that might be going at the roots.
That is such a great idea. I've heard of many people doing that.
I like that idea a lot, too. That's a great tip, and I hope that we will have some more tips. Actually, if you want to join in with a tip of your own, we'd love to hear that as well as comments, as questions to our two guests today as we visit with them. And we're talking today with Jamie Jenkins, who is the founder of AHA, Modern Living, and the host of the Home and Garden podcast, Nest in Style, and Billy Brownell, who is a longtime editor of gardening books. And they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today as we visit with them about their new book, Garden Rules, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.